This episode explores what it takes to work alongside First Nations people and First Knowledges. You're going to meet Lucy and Lauren, both of whom have played a major role in Taxi's rap process. And you'll meet Tasman, who changed his career off the back of Kevin Rudd's apology to the Stolen Generation. Lucy lives, works and plays on Kaurna land, and Lauren and Tasman on Gadigal land. I'm Chris, and I'm on unceded Kaurna land, and I'd like to pay my respects to Kaurna elders past, present and future.
My parents didn't have a huge understanding of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures.
I would say that I had no awareness about my white privilege and what that actually meant.
Trying to deal with this situation of racism, I was reinforcing that, and I was actually...
I felt that my approach of being respectful would be enough.
Trying to move past that discomfort and not sort of sit in that and not take action, and to recognise that we might take missteps, but not...
Like, I'm at work, but don't hesitate to take the step forward, or don't hesitate to ask that question.
Organisations out there need to have it entwined in everything. I think that's just the key. Otherwise, you just... like, say, tick a box and it's done, and you forget about it and you move on with life, and it makes no difference. It doesn't change how you feel or how you react or how you think.
Lucy, where did your cultural learning journey start?
Probably in school. I did quite a lot of school topics. There was always one page or something of the history book that had some Aboriginal, mostly Aboriginal, a little bit of Torres Strait Islander knowledge. I think there was most around art and culture. After leaving school, I probably didn't have too much more reconciliation learning and cultural learning until I started working at Taxi and working with Auntie Vicky. And that's where I really learned how much more there is to do, how much work there is to do around reconciliation, and the role that I play as a non-Aboriginal, non-Torres Strait Islander person in that, and that it's not about me sitting back, it's actually about me taking action around that so that others don't have to.
My parents didn't have a huge understanding of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander cultures or challenges. So it wasn't probably until I got to high school that I really started to get a little bit more knowledge in that space, and through, I guess, more through like a social history kind of lens, I kind of did a bit of study into, like, I guess, Aboriginal ways of knowing and being, and that kind of thread I followed that kind of thread throughout university. And it was very much a thread that at that time wasn't so embodied. I didn't have huge amounts of connection to Aboriginal communities. I think alongside a lot of other white folk, there was a fear around connecting, or like not knowing how to step outside those white circles and go into that culture. And so I connected in the way, I guess, I saw best, as educating myself around like the deep richness of Aboriginal spirituality, culture, coming from a very academic lens. Like, I studied anthropology, which has a hugely troublesome history with Aboriginal communities. And then towards the end of my master's program, actually, I started doing more work with Aboriginal-led organisations in learning and education and scholarship work. That's when I first met Tyson Yonker-Porter, actually. And I think through that connection and through that connection with that organization, there was a bit of an opening in my mind about what it actually means to like walk the talk in a way, and actually, what it looks like to recognize privilege and act as a good ally. Definitely at Taxi, I've been involved in that reconciliation journey more deeply, like alongside Working with Auntie Vicky has been hugely, I think, life-changing in terms of the way she's able to walk in two worlds and, you know, allow us to have questions and hold that space for us, but then also educate us really strongly around, you know, what those, yeah, what really effective ways of working alongside look like. So that's like abridged version of the journey. I think the privilege is, and this was built through, Taxi did a 2-day training a couple of years ago with an organization around, you know, cultural safety and recognizing privilege, white privilege. In Sydney, I was lucky enough to take part in, I guess it was a solidarity circle around, you know, a whole group of people getting together and doing what's known as a privilege walk. So everyone starts in the same line, and it's a really good embodied way to actually see, you know, they'll ask you a series of questions and you either step forward or back. And by the end of that time, where everyone is standing is sort of like, it's a real stark reminder of, you know, there's a lot of like white cis males at the front and then a lot of like diverse folks at the back of that line. And I think for me, that's a really potent way to understand how privilege works and how that can lead to inequitable outcomes in society. So there's also some like really great resources that I was reading around the time, like Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack of Privilege by Peggy McIntosh, and things like that, that had really like direct questions for you to unpack that. But I think in an allyship way, that it's much more than just acknowledging and understanding. From work I've done with Auntie Vicky and other First Nations folks, it is about how you're acting in spaces as well. Like it's, you know, it's sometimes taking up less space, talking less, not coming to meetings where like you're actually not like adding to cultural safety or taking away, prioritizing spaces that have Aboriginal voices always, really leaning into that foregrounding of Aboriginal wisdom, which can include, you know, learning from First Nations ways of doing things, like story work and Auntie Vicky's Yarning with a Purpose, but then all the while acknowledging that those things come from like a really deep culture and we're not trying to appropriate or take them, but there's just so much richness to learn from those practices.
It was, yeah, Sorry Day in 2008, and Kevin Rudd kind of put out a call to the nation for everyone to kind of do their bit to heal our country. And it was sort of at that moment that I kind of realized that why am I spending my practice designing products where I should be kind of focusing more on more important issues. And so sort of from there, I started kind of working in remote communities, doing kind of housing for health projects. It was quite a kind of technical approach, kind of going in and doing research and stoves and things and kind of fixing bits and bobs felt like I was kind of intruding in people's houses and people saying, well, kind of, what are you doing kind of here? But it was the bigger issue of trying to kind of improve the nuts and bolts of sort of houses and then also kind of use that data to kind of address some of the misconceptions about people misusing houses and breaking things. And so it was a bigger kind of interest in the cause, but wasn't particularly kind of connecting with people or countries. And then it wasn't until I started sort of working at Designing Out Crime for the first time, and we were doing a lot of sort of work in the justice system. And there was one kind of project that we were designing a school inside Kempsey Jail, and there was quite a high Aboriginal community in the jail there. And so we sort of started actually kind of working quite closely with the Indigenous inmates and having deep conversations about Indigenous learning and place and country, and that was the first time I started shifting to work differently and to sort of move into kind of partnerships and start kind of working in sort of exchange. And then that sort of continued to sort of snowball. And then more sort of recently within my PhD, worked quite closely with the Barkindji community in Mulcanya to sort of co-design a social centre for men's mental health. And my sort of research focus was broadly how to work more successfully with community, you know, how to kind of connect more deeply and more meaningfully, and doing that through the lens of story, and particularly this idea of kind of shifting story that is an idea I'm kind of pulling from narrative therapy. And it was in that experience there that I sort of was able to actually really deeply, I think for the first time, work in quite beautiful partnership with the community there. And it's where I kind of started learning to actually, I think, be an ally and what it actually means in all its beauty and complexity.
I wonder what your reflections were on that and what your tips would be for other organisations engaging in a RAP process.
Yeah, I think my tips would be to just start. If it's, you know, if it's the right fit for you, I guess there's a question about that first. It is probably a process for more non-Aboriginal organisations. So if you're at a sort of starting point or an early point in your cultural journey as an organisation, which probably most organisations are, then it might be a good fit for you. And it is, yeah, it's just been such a vehicle for everyone who's been involved in the RAP to learn about culture and about themselves and about their roles along the way. So the RAP kind of almost became a secondary thing in our organization to the team who was working on it learning. And so that meant it took a long time, but we really came such a long way through having those conversations and learned how to work together with Aunty Vicky, when not to work with Aunty Vicky, so that she didn't have to sort of hear things that she's been hearing her whole life about us figuring things out and learning things. But yeah, that sort of meant that the organization had a whole group of people who knew sort of how to advocate and how to educate, I guess, each other and the rest of the organization about certain things. So I would say, yeah, get started and do it genuinely, do it with genuine intention, take the time that it needs and be committed to learning a lot along the way.
And what have you learned about your practice and yourself in this last year or so you've been working on this?
Yeah, I think I really learned that in some training that we did at TACSI around cultural respect training with Auntie Sharon and Kathleen. And the sort of big moment for me was learning about how there's a bit of a red zone that causes harm for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people when they're being subjected to racism or unfair treatment or anything that, you know, really just damages their safety and ability to just be themselves. And that there was a role for people to step in, non-Aboriginal people to step in and bear some of that brunt. And for me in that example, it's me stepping in to be uncomfortable so that an Aboriginal person or group of people doesn't have to be hurt. So it's sort of that difference between harm being caused that actually, you know, shortens people's lives and causes them health issues and things like that versus a white woman myself being a bit uncomfortable. So I guess I learned that's sort of the role that I have. And ways that happens, it's different all the time. There's, I suppose, holding the cultural knowledge that you do have or the understanding that you do have in mind and trying to hold that lens in conversations and bringing it into conversation so that other folks in the room who might be Aboriginal don't have to always be the one saying, hey, what about Aboriginal perspective on this? It's about inviting people or making sure people are in the room who should be. It's about educating other white people or calling out or calling in other non-Aboriginal people when they need to do some learning. Aunty Vicky also messages me sometimes in meetings, and then I speak for her, or I sort of translate, or not translate, but I would either speak, sort of let people know what's on her mind, or I would speak instead of her, because she's not in a place where she feels safe, or she feels like I would be listened to more than her, unfortunately. And so that means that I can sort of take on that discomfort in the conversation so that she gets what she needs to get done, but she doesn't have to be the one bearing the brunt of any sort of repercussions. It's also going to marches. There are definitely events that are out there for everybody to show up and show their dedication and their commitment, I guess, to reconciliation. It's also not showing up to some things that are for Aboriginal people only, and knowing when to step out of the room is just as important as knowing when to step into it. Lots of different things.
I think I've learnt, you know, there's a burden in cultural education that, you know, Aboriginal people take on, and for a people that are already, you know, coping with intergenerational trauma, collective trauma, the trauma that comes with climate change, that's not always a space that we can expect Aboriginal folks to be willing to take. So it's not about, you know, finding the first Aboriginal person you find and asking all these questions of them, because, you know, that they aren't your education tool. Like, we need to step beyond and start having the conversations within, like, our communities, and doing that work of educating ourselves before we bring it to others and ask questions, and before we can be in relationship in that true respect and connect sense. And yeah, I guess, like, the other thing is, like, we don't have all the answers. Like, you know, there's plenty of programs that have come into communities in that direct sense where they've decided that there's a thing that they're going to do. And it's very easy to jump to that idea because of, you know, those experiences. But I think what I've learned is that, you know, there's huge richness and wisdom in the communities we work with, and especially from, like, you know, 60,000 plus years of culture and connection to country. Like, there's a lot there that you know, is there to be shared, I guess, and built upon.
And so what's that meant in the project that you're working on now? I think that's been a big theme that's run through the Fire to Flourish project, is foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom and catalyzing Aboriginal leadership, if that's the right way to talk about it.
Absolutely. I think the foregrounding of Aboriginal wisdom is really, like, it's really a backbone principle that's absolutely essential to the context in Australia and that journey of reconciliation we're all on. And that goes through different scales. Like, we're all on individual reconciliation journeys, and then through our communities, and then up to a national scale. So that foregrounding of Aboriginal wisdom, it actually happens through all those different levels. But in that particular project, we heard, and this echoes through other projects I've been on as well, that Aboriginal voices are largely absent from conversations, and people are, like, either over-consulted and not brought in an engaging or participatory way. So, you know, I'll abridge a quote around, like, you know, Aboriginal people are never at the table, they're never in the conversations, and they've just been noticing country and people getting sicker and sicker due to climate change. And for this context, for what we're understanding, you know, First Nations people, that it's not about just, like, a natural environment and a social environment. Climate change affects the ecosystem and the connections between them. So the cultural ties to country, concepts of community-based wellness, you know, they extend beyond human to human connection. That's an ecosystem holistic view on well-being that goes much, much beyond simply the social. Foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom in that program, we really lent into Tyson Yunkaporta's framework of respect, connect, reflect, direct, in that we always started with establishing strong relationships with people, respecting protocols, building cultural safety, practicing things like didiri, deep listening, story work, and seeing the deep wisdom that country holds and that people draw upon. We also, through that process, were building co-designers' capabilities to work alongside Aboriginal peoples and the wisdom in the room, and then also to recognise when it's, when it's their, when they are stepping forward to do work, or when they actually have to leave work for First Nations peoples, because, in a program that's meant to be community-led and about steps that we need to do to build people's capabilities before they can actually do the work. Like, you can't just, I think Auntie Vicky says, you can't just like hand people work and say, there, you're self-determined. Like, due to like the history of colonization, there's a lot of capabilities that are gaps and barriers to Aboriginal people leading that work. So I guess, foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom was about, a couple of, definitely like prioritizing First Nations voices in the room, and when there aren't First Nations voices present, being able to acknowledge the deep cultural wisdom that we're learning from, by taking time to do acknowledgements of country, promoting that connection between the individual and the place they're in, and really embodied processes of learning together. I think, going back to like my own story of like purely academic learning, like that can only take you so far. Like, that there needs to be a process of in groups, learning together in circles, making mistakes, learning from them, really being curious and open and brave to actually have the conversations.
And what do you think the focus on embracing and foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom, like what is in this project, what's that led to, what's resulted from that?
So in the project, the Fight or Flourish project, the principle of foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom has led to the co-design group in Clarence Valley prioritising funding for a project that's called the Ally Project. It's a white co-designer-led project, but it is all about keeping money for cultural competency style, training and work. And in Clarence Valley, there's a couple of festivals that our co-designers are part of, and the money is really going towards the festivals having cultural activities. So they're building their own, understanding of Aboriginal culture, but also helping their communities understand and have exposure to these types of conversations. So the Ally Project is like a seed that has started those conversations, and then the bigger, future vision that Clarence Valley were dreaming up was this big picture movement about walking together. And that's like, what does it mean to walk together and be allies at all those different levels, from the individual to the community to the system? I think the other thing that the Clarence Valley co-designers really noticed in the process was that because we only had one Aboriginal co-designer, and they, because of capacity issues, weren't able to be in the room at all times, the co-designers came up with this sort of, criteria for making decisions around, is this an ally project, or is this going to be truly First Nations led? And what's the work that we need to do to actually get to work alongside or work with Aboriginal people? And they called that the soil detective. So it's like creating the conditions and making the soil rich and, you know, the conditions right for working together.
For many months, we sort of spoke, you know, about what should these partnerships look like between local community and outsiders, and particularly, you know, Aboriginal and Western partnerships, and try and describe that. And by the end of it, there was a man, Brendan, who's actually not Barkindji, he's a Kukuyulangi man, but he's been in Wilcannia for a long time. And he framed it as partnerships should be spiritual barter, which was this sort of really powerful image that has stuck with me. And he said that in spiritual barter, the sort of spirituality has two kind of levels to it. There's connecting, which is connecting around knowledge and practice, which we sort of often think a lot about in partnerships or in exchange in sort of research, for instance. But then he said there's bonding underneath that, which is about connecting personally, where your journeys, your stories, your values and your ways of being are connecting. And that's that kind of barter that happens, you know, when new communities sort of meet each other. And to layer those two together, and particularly with this focus on barter and exchange, seemed to be completely kind of shifted our relationship. It wasn't about one supporting or empowering or teaching the other. You know, connection was about this equal moving together and completely kind of meeting in the middle. And yes, there's obviously power dynamics and all sorts of things kind of at play. But to continue to try to come back to that equal coming together, that kind of that full kind of balance and exchange, felt like it opened up new opportunities for us.
And when you reflect on sort of work that you've done in Aboriginal communities before that time, like what do you think of your sort of older practice?
Well, it was definitely more around, doing to and not doing with. But I also acknowledge that allyship and sort of work in sort of social justice comes in many forms. And the work of that kind of real kind of technical fixing the nuts and bolts of stuff that needs to sort of happen, and then using data to kind of fight the bigger kind of system, is a journey of allyship. And that was, a really powerful act of allyship that took a different form.
Like, what can I do to be a better ally? Like, what are some of the things that I should think about?
Go on country. Like, you can think about it philosophically, and you can have tools and toolkits to do it, but you've got to actually build the deep connection and motivation to be an ally, and that's the most important thing. And that comes through understanding, connections, friendships, creative projects. I was sort of, and it's hard, you know, to have the time to do that, but you need to prioritize it. I was sort of lucky enough through my PhD to have the flexibility of being a student. This is before I had a kid, and I was, you know, floating, and was able to, in that collaboration with the men's group in Wilcannia, you know, to go out there for many months, you know, stints, you know, spend 2 months there, spend 3 months there, come back for a few months, go back for a few months, over years and years to actually kind of spend deep time hanging out with people and connecting to country and learning deeply. About everything, about myself as a white person on this country and what that means, and coming to place with my own identity, understanding the communities, you know, deeper than those kind of first level stories that you kind of can only hear from the outside, and feeling it, you know, feeling that country in your heart.
There was a really important role that Auntie Vicky played around, you know, like listening and holding space for conversation, but also provocation. And she said something really that I think that really stuck with some co-designers, because it came up again and again in reflection around, you know, Auntie Vicky said, like, come and sit under my tree. It was an invitation. And I think that's the invitation of most First Nations people. It is like, you know, come and sit under our tree. Like, we don't always have to be coming to you and your way of doing. Like, I think it's time that, you know, we go sit under the tree in that context instead.
I feel very lucky to have been in the presence of Auntie Vicky, and who has had deep and sort of profound impact on all of us as practitioners and community as well. And to have that just continual presence, just being there, and offering that kind of ongoing perspective and ongoing education has been invaluable. And then that ongoing safe space for us to stuff up and ask shit questions, and for her to very generously think about the bigger journey beyond her, and make sacrifices to support people, and she's been very open about how that's her job as an educator, but she's now kind of getting exhausted with that and wants to pass on the kind of education to us, and for us to take on that role of educating people and being allies, which I think is a really important call to action, and it's also again a bit of that sort of permission thing too. You know, you see that discomfort of primary school teachers, you know, white primary school teachers, for instance, not feeling like they're allowed to kind of have permission to kind of teach those stories or share that kind of knowledge. But it's important that it's spoken about en masse, and that everyone takes on that role. I think, walking that line of the nuance of acknowledging and knowing, doing it from your perspective and your place, as a white person and as an ally, is the next journey to learn for me.
What's next for you on your cultural learning journey?
I'm actually traveling to Uluru for a holiday next month. So that will be a learning journey. I definitely when I was younger, I've been there and probably did some things that I wouldn't do now that I know better. So it will be great to go back and look through a different lens. And I did learn a lot when I was there last time, but learn more this time. What else? Oh, so at TACSI, we are just documenting our reconciliation and cultural learning opportunities that we have available, both for new staff that are coming on board to make sure that they're equipped to do the work that we do, in a culturally appropriate and safe way, but also the ongoing opportunity and work that needs to be done for reconciliation and cultural learning. So we're just trying to capture that and look at how we want that to evolve over time. So that's what we're working on.
I think for me, it's it's continuing to understand like how I'm working alongside First Nations people, and yeah, I guess continuing foregrounding Aboriginal wisdom and understanding what good allyship is, because like there's no ending to this journey. Like it's not a capability that has like a roof. You know, I think, yeah, that there's big systemic ambition that I hold, like, you know, the voice to parliament, and like campaigning for that and in my own small way. And I think it, on a personal level, I think I want to continue, I guess, helping change the mindsets and the behaviours of the people around me, like from friends and family, taking action on, you know, the things that are not okay on reconciliation journeys, or like helping people have reconciliation journeys as well. I think that's probably what I'll continue to lean into.
I think next is, you know, so we're part of the sort of Fire to Flourish team, a project, which is, you know, a huge project across many communities, around, you know, looking at bushfire recovery and resilience, but sort of more broadly, you know, holistic wellbeing and a lot of projects, a lot of people, a lot of money involved. And I think I'm exploring, as we all are, ways to sort of be an ally on that scale. My other projects have been very intimate, you know, about collaborative making and sitting with five people for months making things around a table, you know, that kind of level. And I think now I'm moving into this kind of bigger thing around, you know, structural equality and being ally at that level. And, you know, within a program, you know, how to sort of support big behemoth projects and programs to set up structures that actually foreground Aboriginal wisdom and give power, you know, share power with First Nations communities.